Accession number 10589, Reel 2.
Mr. Gillard, Reel 2.
I concentrated on the air battle, and I presented a fairly cheerful picture of that, because I genuinely believed that we had achieved air supremacy over the landing zone. In fact, it turned out subsequently that, of course, our losses were much greater than I thought, and even the story I told her about the air battle couldn't in the end be substantiated. I may tell you that in recent times, well, 4 or 5 years ago, I did a Radio 4 documentary about the Dieppe raid, and very carefully made certain that my own dispatch was not used in that documentary, because it gives me a pain in the mind to think about it, even today, that I might inadvertently have given an impression of a success which certainly we did not achieve. I was 2 years later with the Canadian forces for the liberation of Dieppe. I most deliberately saw to it. I was in charge of the BBC's reporting team in France by then, and I deliberately assigned myself to that part of the operation because I wanted to go in and see precisely what the coastal defences around Dieppe actually were like, which the Germans had created. And once you'd seen them, I mean, you realise all over again how futile our plans were for this one-day invasion back in 1942, how utterly absurd it was to conceive that we could possibly carry out the rosy objectives that were presented to us by Churchill Mann on the eve of the first sailing. The entry into Dieppe at the time of final victory there, I shall always remember, because the people of Dieppe had obtained a very large Nazi banner, which they laid right across the roadway which led in from the west into Dieppe, across which every vehicle of the Anglo-American forces had to pass, or Anglo-Canadian forces passed, no Americans there, Anglo-Canadians. And so we, all of us, went into Dieppe trampling the Nazi flag into the dust as we went. It was a wonderful gesture, I think. Very colourful. Dieppe was, I think, the 19th of August. It was around about that time, anyway, in 42. I went on into the autumn of 42 doing my usual routine war reporting jobs with the Home Forces. But then by the middle of the autumn, it was fairly clear that that the BBC would need to make some changes in North Africa, where we had Godfrey Talbot was already there. But the second BBC post in North Africa was vacant and had to be filled. It had been Richard Dimbleby, who'd been actually there before Godfrey took over. And Richard, unfortunately, had to be recalled because his standing with the army had deteriorated. He, in my view, was an absolutely first-class reporter, and he certainly was an admirable man and in every respect, and he's a great friend of mine and to his death, and I have great regard for him. He had for a long time, in the earlier stages of the North African campaign, been there single-handed. Any war reporter has to make up his mind whether he's going to get his news through personal observation or whether he's going to get it from some rear headquarters. And there are pluses and minuses in each case. If you are going to report things that you've seen with your own eyes, you take a great chance every day, because you don't necessarily know where the action is going to be at its most significant or its fiercest. The enemy determines that as much as anybody, and the enemy is not revealing his hand to you or to anybody else. So you go to a position on the battlefront where you think something is likely to happen, and nothing happens because the enemy has sprung a surprise attack somewhere else and you're not there to report it. And your newspaper, your broadcast editor, your news editor back home wants to know why you weren't there. So it's a risky job. On the other hand, if you take your news from a divisional headquarters or a corps headquarters or further back still army headquarters, it is all second-hand stuff. You're not reporting what you have seen with your own eyes. You have to accept what is given to you, and it may or may not be accurate. And I have to say that there were times throughout the war where the war correspondents were misled, quite deliberately misled, especially the broadcasting correspondents, in the interests of deceiving the enemy, who were known to be listening to you. Monty himself confesses that he deliberately misled us at one point in the Normandy campaign and regretted it afterwards. But it happened. I personally always preferred to be reporting, therefore, what I saw with my own eyes. Richard Dimbleby, and understandably he was single-handed, decided he could give a better service to the BBC and to broadcast listeners if he obtained a more comprehensive report from headquarters. And the truth is that in North Africa he was manipulated. The North African command, of course, was extremely anxious, and fair dues to them, that they should get as much as possible of the reinforcements, of the new weapons, and of the military supplies generally, which the UK was able to produce. The North African command wanted to see all that stuff being passed out to them in vast quantity. On the other hand, back here at home, the high command in Whitehall knew perfectly well that a proportion of our new armaments had to be somehow or other got to the Russians, our allies, that we had to build up a strong striking force in this country so that eventually we could get back into Europe and liberate the countries, the Allied countries, now under German subjection, and so on. And there was therefore conflict, really, between Middle East Command and home army authorities. And the Middle East Command, recognising that Richard Dimbleby commanded a very large audience and was very influential in Britain, used him and supplied him with information and stories and that sort of thing, which tended to support them all the time and support their claims and build up their rights. And this became, in the end, pretty intolerable, as seen from London. There was also this awkward situation, which I've mentioned, that Richard tended to take his material, his information, from various headquarters. And that information was not always quite accurate, and sometimes gravely inaccurate. But B, this was happening at a time in battle circumstances where the situation was always fluid. It was always fluid in the desert. And an army, well, a divisional commander, a brigade commander, might think that he's making a pretty good advance and doing rather well, and his reports coming back would be very optimistic. Whereas what he didn't know was that while he was certainly making some penetration on a front in which lay before him, an enemy front, the enemy at the same time had sent out a pretty powerful arm which was getting through the desert, round, doing a big circular movement, to come in behind the British forces, cut them off, and force them to withdraw. This happened again and again and again. We did it, they did it. It's the form of desert warfare, particularly tank warfare, because tanks are so manoeuvrable in open areas like the desert. Where this didn't matter too much as far as the newspaper war reporters were concerned, because their stuff took 6 weeks or more to get back to the troops on the spot. Richard Dimbleby's stuff, on the other hand, came back within 24 hours over the air, and everybody in the army listened to it. They all had radio sets of one kind and another. And there would be Richard giving an account over the air, based on information received back at headquarters, of a promising advance, and everything was looking rather encouraging and rather good, just at the moment when the attack in the rear was moving in, and all the advancing troops were suddenly having to go backwards again in order to avoid being cut off. And, of course, they were looking for a scapegoat, as everybody always does in such circumstances. And what better scapegoat than this silly ass who's telling us over the air that all is going fine and we're making a great advance here, when, in fact, just the reverse is happening. So Richard's name, his standing with the Middle East armies, unfortunately, went down and down and down. Not basically his fault. Not basically. And it became necessary for Richard to come home. And so in the late autumn of 1942, and somebody else had to go out, and the choice fell on me. And so I left to go out and join the 8th Army just shortly after the Battle of Alamein. Battle of Alamein was completed. Monty's 8th Army was advancing across the North African littoral towards Tripoli. Now, the business of actually getting from London out to join Monty was very interesting. You see, the whole of Europe, continental Europe, was under German occupation. The Mediterranean was a German sea. And so the only means of getting to North Africa was to do a huge circular journey by air, which took you from England right down into the West African coast, deep down into Africa, and then across the whole heart of Africa to Khartoum, and then down the Nile to Cairo. A long journey. Now, in the middle of the war, scheduled air services, commercial air services, were few and far between. And what happened to me, and it happened to a great many other people, was this. I took an Imperial Airways flying boat from Poole in Dorset, which was where the Imperial Airways base was located. And it flew, first of all, to Foynes in Eire, where we stayed overnight. In fact, we stayed there for 36 hours, if I remember rightly. Then we set out from Foynes, and we flew out in this flying boat by night out into the Atlantic. Had to be done by night because the German long-range fighters, Focke Wulfs, based on Brest, the Brest Peninsula, were roaming about all the time, shooting down all our aircraft, whether civil or otherwise. We went deep out into the Atlantic right through the night and then turned and came in again towards dawn and came in at Lisbon. We stayed at Lisbon, and countless people had to do this trip in this way. Came in at Lisbon, spent a day or so in Lisbon, 36 hours, then out again into the Atlantic in the dusk, a great sweeping sort of hairpin journey, which brought us back to Gambia, to Bathurst in the Gambia. Again, a wait at Bathurst, and again, a flight out into the Atlantic, which this time swung us in to Lagos. And that was as far as Imperial Airways would carry us, Lagos in Nigeria. Then you had the job of getting across the whole continent of Africa, and you were left to your own devices to do it. And the continent of Africa is some 3,000 miles in width and uninhabited and very, very unsociable. And the trick was that you got yourself up from Lagos to Kano, which was a kind of crossroads of the world in many ways. And at Kano, you ingratiated yourself with the aircraft supply service, which carried out the reinforcement of the North African Desert Air Force. The Desert Air Force drew most of its aircraft from the United States. They were crated and shipped over to the Nigerian port of Takoradi. At Takoradi, they were assembled and tested. And from there, they were flown to Kano. And Kano was a kind of assembly point. When enough of these little fighter planes were assembled at Kano, they would take off in a sort of drove of a dozen or more, each convoy accompanied by a four-engined, prop-driven military aeroplane, an Ensign, a very old-fashioned design, not equipped at all for passengers, no seats or anything like that, but loaded with supplies and kit, that sort of thing, for the little aircraft, for the little fighter planes, and for the pilots of those planes. And you would fly in convoy as far as the range of the little fighters would permit, which was about 600 miles. And at the end of that, at the end of the first leg, down you would come at a clearing in the desert, which the RAF had created. And there was a refueling point, which the RAF kept supplied with fuel all the time. Tanker planes flew in with loads of the stuff. And the little fighters would get refueled, and your own aircraft would get refueled, and after a few hours, you'd all take off again and do another 600 miles. An absolutely memorable and almost wildly incredible journey, because while you were up in the air, you were frozen, you were at 10,000 feet and absolutely frozen. Then suddenly you do a nosedive down onto this wretched little improvised landing strip where you could easily fry an egg on the ground. It was so hot. And it was very tough on the constitution. And you did this series of hops across North Africa, lying up at night at one or other of these little stopping places, and just wrapped up in whatever blanket you could acquire, and lying on the ground. And eventually you finished up at Khartoum. And from Khartoum, you then produced your air ticket, and you picked up a commercial air service flying down the Nile to Cairo. Most remarkable journey, very well described by Lord Tedder in his book, which is called With Prejudice. But that was the trip that I did, and she'll never forget. And so I finally arrived in Cairo. I'd spent Christmas Day, I remember, in Lagos in Nigeria, and I got to Cairo just for New Year's Day. And at once assumed the job of being the BBC correspondent at General Headquarters, because the other BBC man with the Eighth Army was Godfrey Talbot, and he was up with the army on the advance to Tripoli. The Cairo, I found the Cairo reporting job very frustrating indeed. You went to two press conferences a day, at which the man who was called the official spokesman, sometimes called the voice of Cairo, I remember, and just handed out whatever news GHQ thought it was good for the war reporters in Cairo to have. You had no means whatever checking it, or confirming it or otherwise. But you did have the advantage in Cairo of having direct communication with London twice daily. The Egyptian state government operated a very effective and reliable shortwave beam radio service, a commercial service, from Cairo to London. And the BBC had a block booking on this thing from 12 noon to 12:30 at Cairo time, and again at night from, I think, midnight to midnight 30. So you had two dates each day with London. And you put over whatever news you'd been able to gather yourself from GHQ in Cairo. And you also, in those periods, put over whatever recordings your colleague up with the Eighth Army, in my case my colleague was Godfrey Talbot, whatever recordings he had managed to send back to you. All this material had to be censored. It had to be censored four times over. The army censors had to cope with it. The naval censors had to cope with it. The RAF censors had to cope with it. And the Egyptian state government insisted on censoring it. Egypt, you will remember, was not at war. Egypt was a country, a neutral country, occupied by the British. And the Egyptian state government was still remarkably sensitive about what its commercial shortwave beam transmitter was saying. And often, particularly on if one attempted to talk about civil affairs in Egypt, as sometimes one did, was very sensitive about those and had a lot to do with them. But you had to take your material, whether it was on script or whether it was on disc, to these four offices, one after another. And both the script and the disc had to bear the stamp of censor's approval before you then, after going through this fourfold business of censorship, took it to the studio of the transmitting station and beaming it to London on these daily bookings of 12 noon or midnight. And that is how we kept the service going. In London, this stuff was received, was recorded, and was then available for use, provided the censors in London also passed it. There was a further censorship operation in London. So it had to go through many, many channels before it finally got to the air. The method of censorship in Cairo was extremely crude. In my time, it was most often the censor just simply took out a pocket knife from his pocket. And if there was something on a record that he didn't approve of, he just stopped the record from playing. There was a disc record. And he just applied his pocket knife to those particular grooves and scoured them out. And often he scoured out the grooves in front and the grooves behind as well. So that by the time the stuff got to London, it was much interrupted and much mutilated. But nevertheless, some reporting and valuable reporting got back. The time came when Tripoli fell, Godfrey Talbot made some memorable recordings of the fall of Tripoli, which got back to me in Cairo, and I got them across on this beam service to London. I'd been able to supplement that a bit in anticipation by getting hold of people in Cairo who knew Tripoli very well, Egyptians and others, and getting them to talk to me about Tripoli so that people at home had some picture of the city which we were about to capture. And so we were able to work in reasonably well and get a decent picture of the situation home to listeners in London. And at the fall of Tripoli, Godfrey, who'd been now with the army for quite some time and was suffering from desert sores and wasn't too happy at all, desperately wanted to get back, and I was desperately anxious to go forward and have a look at Tripoli for myself and get up with the army. So we managed to change places. That was extremely difficult. I mean, we were 1,500 miles apart by then, which is a long way with no proper road connections, you know, just trackways across all that length of desert. So I took over from Tripoli onwards, right through to the end of the war in North Africa. During that time, I got thoroughly well acquainted with Monty. I first got to know Monty well at the time of the Battle of the Mareth Line, which was a real set-piece operation in which he had thrown in the bulk of his forces across what in North Africa is called a wadi, but is really a vast kind of ditch, deep and very wide. And in all of them, as the Germans repeated, were heavily fortified against us. And Monty had launched a frontal attack across this great wadi, the Wadi Akarit, in order that he could push his forces on up towards Tunis. And the Germans on the other side had all the advantages, and we got very badly mauled in that operation. And I remember meeting Monty on the day that we all of us realized that the advance had not been successful. And I said, "Dear, oh dear, disaster," or words to that effect, to Monty. And he said, "Not at all, not at all. Not at all. I always foresaw this would happen." He said, "What I've got now happening is a left hook. You'll see my left hook in operation. I've thrown out," he said, "a battle force, and it's going to swing around, and it's going to get right through behind the Germans, and you'll soon see Rommel pulling out of the Wadi Akarit." So I took his tip and rushed back and got myself a seat in a Lysander, I think it was. Yes, it was a Lysander aircraft. Anyway, it was an artillery spotting plane, and flew out over this route that he had shown to me on his map that he was sending out this battle force, and lo and behold, there it was behind, down on the ground below us, battling away through the sand. And I subsequently learnt that, in fact, it was a route that the French, who, of course, were the rightful owners of that territory, had always said was quite impossible to military forces. But we'd sent out a long-range desert group for inspection purposes in advance, and they said they thought we could do it. And there was this army. It was a task force, really, under the command of Horrocks. And also involved in it was the great Australian general, whose name, of course, I've forgotten at the moment. Never mind, I'll think of it. Anyway, I had a wonderful view of this operation from the air. Came back, recorded a quick dispatch about it, which got sent back to London with all speed. And which I may say was one of the very few dispatches of the war for which I received congratulations from the office back home. They were very sparse with their congratulations. But anyway, I then thought my job is to catch up with that column and get round with them. If they can get through, I can get through. So I got onto my recording truck and my recording engineer. And although this recording truck of ours was by no means, it wasn't even a four-wheel drive, if I remember rightly. But we ploughed through and we caught up with everything in front of us. And we went around, and it worked exactly as Monty had said. I mean, it was a marvellous battle, the Mareth Line battle. I mean, real classic battle, where you had tanks. I'd not seen it before. Tanks advancing by moonlight, led, need I say, by Horrocks. And right in behind Rommel's lines, and he had to pull out with all speed. And so the Wadi Akarit was cleared. It was a great battle, and one I vividly remember. And then we went on from there up through the last area of North Africa, which had to be conquered before we could get to Tunis, and we entered Sousse and we entered Sfax, these great seaport cities. Well, they weren't great cities, but seaport cities, and we were in now much less of desert conditions, but much more in semi-civilized conditions anyway, with different kind of battle altogether. But we got through, and at last we found that we were up against mountainous territory in the area of Unfideville, which is right at the head of the peninsula, which we simply could not penetrate. We tried again and again, but it really was like climbing vertical cliff faces the whole time, and the Germans were well positioned. And as we attempted to scale these positions, I mean, they just picked us off one after another, quite hopeless. And so it was quite obvious that the way to finish off the war in North Africa was for the important section of the Eighth Army, that is, a couple of armoured divisions, a couple of good infantry divisions, to be switched around inland, around the back of this mountainous barrier, to link up with the troops of the First Army, who were coming through from Algiers and had had a pretty rough time of it, and reinforce them and get into Tunis from the west. And I went with them, with my recording truck, and linked up with the First Army and met up with the BBC team with the First Army. The reporter there was a man called Howard Marshall. And Howard and I went in with them for the final battle which liberated Tunis and which liberated Bizerta. Howard described on the air the liberation of Tunis, and I described the liberation of Bizerta. And then Howard went back home with all speed. I stayed because I had no interest in going back home. Things out there were much too interesting. And I was able then to do all the stories which naturally ensued after the fact that we had destroyed the enemy in North Africa. I mean, there were great stories about how the whole area was cleaned up and the last Germans were combed out, and the vast numbers of prisoners that we'd taken and the great enemy POW camps and so on and so on and so on. All the booty that we'd assembled, oh, it was wonderful. This was the time when Churchill decreed that all the church bells of Britain should ring out. They'd all been suppressed during the earlier part of the war. And I went and got the bells of Tunis and the bells of Carthage and recorded them and got them back to London so that the bells of Britain could be blended with the bells of North Africa in this great victory sort of celebration. It was wonderful. Then, of course, followed very quickly the business of getting across the Mediterranean in order to continue the war on the mainland of Europe. The first of these, the first great step was to clean up the wretched little islands that stuck up out of the Mediterranean. One of these was Lampedusa, which was a small island. There's nothing particular to say about Lampedusa. Another was Pantelleria. Now, Pantelleria is the top of a volcano that sticks out of the Mediterranean. And it was entirely garrisoned by Italian forces, but they'd been there for a very long time. They were well settled in, and they got most marvellous gun positions and defensive positions right the way up the face of this extinct volcano.